You're listening to the Primary Medicine Podcast with Kevin and Dimitri, bringing you the best in primary care CME that you can use in your everyday practice.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Primary Medicine Podcast. My name is Dimitri, and I'm a family doctor who with a practice in Gatineau, a walk-in practice in Ottawa, Ontario, a fertility practice in Montreal, and I'm also a faculty lecturer at McGill. And welcome to the Primary Medicine Podcast. Today we're going to talk about spirometry. Really, what you do is spirometry, you're determining how well patients' lungs are working, and you do that by measuring how much air they can push out, and how much air they can push in, and how fast they can do it. And why am I talking about spirometry? Well, it's actually quite important. And to drive the point home, I'll go through a couple of studies here to see why it's an important test, and why maybe we should order it more often than we are. There was a study that was done in around 2011, 2012 in Canada, and it found that 30%, so a third of patients who were diagnosed with asthma by their physicians did not actually have asthma when they did spirometry, right? So that's a pretty big false positive rate there. Then similar study was done in Australia, but in this case it was they actually looked at COPD, and it showed that only 50% of patients that were diagnosed with COPD by their family doctors had it when spirometry was done. So 50% false positive rate. And what's crazier about in the study is that 40% of those patients actually had restrictive lung disease. Okay, so the bottom line here is that, unfortunately, it seems to be hard for us to diagnose asthma, COPD, and restrictive lung disease based only on symptoms. And indeed, in younger patients, it can be really hard to diagnose these conditions because spirometry is not an option. But we should be ordering spirometry more often to make sure that our diagnosis is correct. So, what are some of the indications for spirometry here? Obviously, as I mentioned, diagnosing disease. But that's not the only indication. Another one that's very often seen in primary practice is actually assessing the severity of disease or the progression of disease. So, for example, you can assess if your COPD patient has progressed since last time you did the spirometry, whether his values or her values are much worse. You can even assess disease progression of things such as ALS or MS, you know, because these things will affect the chest wall. So these are restrictive type of diseases. You can assess their progression using spirometry. Then a third indication for doing spirometry, and again, this is actually done less often in primary practice, is that you can use it to risk stratify your patients before surgery. For example, if a patient needs a lobectomy, then the surgeon might often do a spirometry to see what their reserve currently is and whether the lobectomy is going to be too much for them. Now, before I move on to talking about interpretation of spirometry, I need to do two things. The first thing is I need to define some very important spirometric values and terms. And the second thing is I'll discuss how these measurements are actually affected by obstructive or restrictive diseases. So let's start with the definitions first. Definition number one, forced vital capacity. Also, short form is FVC. That's the total volume of air that can be exhaled during a maximal forced expiratory effort. So how much air can you push out of your lungs if you force yourself? This is a surrogate for your total lung capacity. Now, if you remember your lung physiology, actually measuring your total lung capacity can be really hard because there's always a certain amount of volume that will stay in your lungs to keep your lungs from collapsing. And then you have to measure that using calculations, using, you know, a closed chamber. Anyways, I'm not going to go through this. But the forced vital capacity is actually a surrogate for that, right? So you can measure forced vital capacity much more easily than your total lung capacity. The second term is your forced expiratory volume in 1 second. Also, the short form is FEV1. This is the volume of air you can exhale in the first second. So if you force yourself, how much can you take, how much air can you push out of your lungs? The third term is a ratio. It's the FEV1 over FVC. This is the percentage or the ratio of FVC of your total your forced vital capacity that you can push out in the first second. There's two other important terms that we're going to talk about, which are not specifically related to spirometry. The first one is the DLCO, which is the diffusing capacity of the lung for carbon monoxide, and that's part of your full pulmonary function tests. And the second term is the lower limit of normal, or the LLN. This is defined as below the 5th percentile of spirometry data, so it could be for anything. You could have the lower limit of normal for FEV1 or for your FVC. And the way you can measure that is there's actually a calculator where you put in the age, the race, the height of your patient, and it gives you all the LLNs. The link will be in the show notes on the website for that calculator, and I will put it on the blog as well, so it can be easily accessed. So, these are definitions. That's the first thing I want to talk about before going into interpretation. The second thing I want to talk about now is how are these measurements affected in obstructive and restrictive disease. And I think this is really important. It's probably one of the most, well, this is to me the most important part of my talk. You know, it's really easy to interpret spirometry if you understand this, if you actually understand what's happening. That's why I like spirometry, because it makes sense once you understand it. So let's talk about restrictive disease. Now, what is happening in restrictive disorder? Well, either because of the chest wall or because of the lung parenchyma, the lung compliance is low. What that means is that it's harder for somebody to put volume of, to actually increase the volume of the lung. It takes a lot of work, and sometimes it takes too much work. What that means is that lung volumes tend to be lower compared to somebody who does not have a restrictive disease. Remember, restrictive disease could be an issue with the chest wall, for example, obesity, or a neuromuscular disorder such as MS or ALS, or the parenchyma, such as a pulmonary fibrosis. In both cases, the compliance is low. It's much harder to open that lung. So volumes are low. What does it mean? Well, if volumes are low, really what is actually affected the most is your FVC. So your FVC decreases substantially in a restrictive disorder. Your FEV1 initially may not be affected at all. And that makes sense, because the FEV1 is a specific percentage of the FVC. So if the FVC is still okay in terms of volume, then the FEV1 is not affected. Eventually, as the FVC decreases more and more, you start seeing changes in the FEV1. So if the FVC is decreased and the FEV1 decreases less, obviously your FEV1 over FVC ratio is higher. And the way it's defined with using the GOLD criteria, it should be higher than 0.7%. All right? So restrictive disorders affect the FVC substantially. Now, what about obstructive disorders? Let's think about it again. So, well, when you have an obstruction, what's happening is that when you're blowing air out, less of it can come out within a specific period of time. Well, that means that the FEV1 will be decreased substantially, right? So as you're blowing air out, you're doing your best to blow out as much as you can, but because there's some obstruction coming up, not as much is coming out. So FEV1 will decrease substantially. The FVC initially may stay normal. So, you know, even if there's an obstruction, you may be able to push out as much air as you were before, although it might take you longer, right? So the FVC may not be affected. However, eventually, as you get hyperinflation of your lungs, what happens is the FVC will decrease. And again, let's think about this. So as your lungs hyperinflate, what's happening is that you have air trapping. So this air can't come out. So your lung volume might be increasing, actually, but the amount of volume you can push out decreases. So the FVC will eventually decrease. But the thing that is affected the most is the FEV1. So again, let's review. In restrictive disorders, FVC decreases. In obstructive disorders, FEV1 decreases. So that's all we need to proceed now. So let's talk about interpretation. Now, there's a couple ways you can interpret it. The way I'm covering it is based on American criteria. There is actually a Canadian algorithm that can be accessed. And if you go to the website and look at the show notes, one of the articles talks about this. It's called the New Spirometry Interpretation Algorithm. It's actually an algorithm that's been published by the Primary Care Respiratory Alliance. And it's a very good algorithm. I like it as well. So either or are fine. I prefer the American one because it makes more sense to me in terms of identifying restrictive disorders. But both are good approaches. And both are very similar, actually. There's a couple of differences that I won't really cover, but they're both very similar. So the first step is always to look at the FEV1 over FVC ratio. That's your first step. Well, really the first step is making sure that the measurement is valid. But the most cases, unless you're doing your own spirometry, that will be done by the technician. Anyways, so that's the first step. The second step is you look at your FEV1 over FVC ratio. Okay, so it could either be high to 0.7 or 70% or lower than 0.7. So what if it's lower than 0.7? Well, then you're most likely dealing with an obstructive disorder. Okay? So what is the next thing? So let's say that we're going down this path, the obstructive disorder path. And, you know, for people who are listening to this, you know, you can download the notes and there's the actual algorithm right in the show notes. If you're more visual, this might make more sense to you. But let's say we're going down the obstructive path. So your FEV1 or FVC is less than 0.7. So what is the next thing you want to look at? It's your FVC, or your forced vital capacity. So remember that an obstructive disorder, unless you're dealing with a, you know, end-stage hyperinflation problem, your FVC should be normal or slightly decreased. So you look at the FVC, and you see if it's within the lower limit of normal. If the FVC is within the lower limit of normal, so it's normal or slightly decreased, then most likely you're doing with an purely obstructive process, right? Purely obstructive. And your next step is to do your bronchodilator therapy and see if there is a response. Remember, the definition of a response here is 12% improvement in the FEV or FVC1 and over 200 cc's improvement as well. So if you have a response, if you get that, you're dealing with asthma. It's a reversible airway obstructive disease, asthma. If you don't have a response, then most likely you're dealing with COPD, a non-reversible obstructive disease. Okay, so let's go back. What if your FVC is actually low? Well, in that case, you might be dealing with a restrictive problem, right? You might be having an actual mixed pattern, an obstructive and a restrictive disease. But in that case, your next step is still to look at the bronchodilator therapy results. So if the bronchodilator therapy shows an increase in your FVC, so an improvement in your forced vital capacity, then most likely what you're dealing with is that hyperinflation person that has decreased FVC because of that extra air trapping. So most likely you're doing an obstructive disease. If on the other hand, the bronchodilator therapy does nothing at all, or barely anything, I should say, then you're most likely dealing with a mostly restrictive disorder, and you should move on and do your pulmonary function testing. Okay? So that's for the obstructive side. Let's go to the restrictive side, which is much simpler. So again, let's say that you have a patient and their FEV1 or FVC is actually higher than 0.7%. Well, what's your next step? You look at the FVC. If it's a restrictive disorder, the FVC should be lower than your lower limit of normal. And if that's the case, that's pretty much a diagnosis of a restrictive disorder. Your next step is to do your pulmonary function testing. On the other hand, if the FVC is not lower than normal, well, maybe this person has nothing wrong with them at all. Or it's one of those people where you have to do the bronchoprovocation testing. You know, you know, they come in, they're coughing, they respond to Ventolin, you do the PF, you do the spirometry, and you don't find anything. you're pretty sure that they have asthma. Well, your next step is to do the metacholine challenge test, for example, or other types of bronchoprovocation tests. Okay? That makes sense? So again, you know, look at the algorithm. It's in the show notes. You can also find it online. And as long as you understand that the FVC will go down in obstructive disorders and the FEV1 will decrease in obstructive disorders, this will make sense. So a quick note on diagnosis. I did mention this a bit when I was talking about the gold criteria for diagnosing COPD. So we all know these in Canada. That COPD can be diagnosed with if the FEV1 or FVC is less than 0.7. Okay. However, that's not the only way you can diagnose it. The American Thoracic Society has their own criteria, which they use the FEV1 or VC, but as opposed to saying 0.7%, they say that it should be lower than the LLN, the lower limit of normal, based on the age, race, and height of the patient. Now, the reason why we tend to use the gold criteria is because studies show that those are the patients patients that were diagnosed with the gold criteria are more likely to be hospitalized. So those are the patients we should actually, you know, catch and treat preferentially. However, there's some evidence that with the gold criteria, 50% of young adults with obstructive disease may be underdiagnosed, and it may overdiagnose healthy non-smokers. So there have been some suggestions that gold criteria used for patients over 65 and the ATA is under 65, whether that's going to come into Canada and whether it's going to make a big change in Canadian diagnosis for these disorders, I can't say. But I thought it's interesting to mention it. And I'll finish off by talking about setting up your own office spirometry. So, since spirometry is quite important, and let's say that you're somewhere where it's really hard for you to access spirometry, it may be worth looking into actually doing office spirometry. I'll quickly cover this. I mean, a proper spirometer setup can cost you anywhere from $2,000 to $4,000. There is a RespTrek course that is approved by CTS. In Canada, it costs around $550. So you're looking at about $5,000 to set up. And the consumables themselves, every time you see a patient or do a reading, is $5 to $10. Thankfully, there's some billing codes both in Ontario and in Quebec to help offset some of the costs. So you'll tell you can charge an extra code for performing in reading spirometry, which ends up being $17. And if you read it post-bronch as well, you can add $7. So you get to $24 extra for doing it. And in Quebec, you get around $16 for the full reading as well. So again, it might make sense, depending on your practice, too. Office spirometry might not make sense. I think it's important to consider.
Since Wahid is here for this podcast, I think it's interesting to ask him this question. But so, Wahid, do you do any peak flow measurements, or have you done any spirometry in any of the clinics you practice in?
No, I typically don't. If I use my gestalt in terms of whether somebody is having trouble or not, and I would send them to the emergency department if they are having trouble.
And if you're trying to diagnose, for example, COPD or asthma, do you have easy access to spirometry?
Most of the places I work have some sort of pulmonary function testing within about half an hour distance of where I am. So in order to get that testing done, it's quite easy.
Yeah, and the wait times aren't too horrible.
Correct, yeah. Hopefully. Yeah. It's not as good as x-rays, but it's not as bad as MRIs.
Right. So again, it's not always worth investing in a spirometer, obviously, if you have easy access. But if you're in a more remote community, it might be worth investing. Remember that you can bill for both reading and performing the spirometry. But yeah, thanks for your input that way. Why hidden? One of the reasons you're here is because you want to talk about, we have an app now. Like everybody has an app, so we decide we have to have an app as well. So maybe we can talk a bit about our app, which should be available on our website when I post this podcast.
Yeah, so as Dimitri said, we got a little bit ambitious. Everybody else has an app and a podcast, so why shouldn't we have both?
Right.
So we developed this app for family medicine residents who are approaching exam time. And it's an app with kind of just salient points with regards to the family medicine exam for Canada, the CCFP examination. It has some information regarding the SUS, but primarily is for the short answer questions. Some updated information regarding the new guidelines and kind of points that we found were important for us to know when we're taking our exam. It essentially goes through the 99 topics that the CCFP has provided and answers the questions under each point in as concise a manner as Dimitri and I can put it.
Yeah, we try to really cut down all the fat and make it into something as concise as possible. It's sort of a similar to our book, the book we have on, it's again going to be on the website just to remind you guys. But it's, for some people it's easier. I think it's easier to navigate, through an app. And I know all the kids now are always on their phones. So we thought it'd be important to have that for them.
Yeah. If you want to take time off your Pokemon Go and study a little bit, this is a perfect opportunity.
Yeah. Multitask. Pokemon Go and study for your CFPC exam, exactly. So it's going to be on the website. You can check it out. And if you have any comments or any concerns or any suggestions regarding the app, please let us know. You can email us at the email on the website or even leave a message on our wall or on our iTunes. But yeah, we're quite excited. Hopefully it's useful for all the residents out there. Anyways, thank you for coming in again, Waheed. It's been a pleasure and we'll talk again.
Thank you very much. Take care.